Up next is Circle A Radio, and the topic they're discussing is gay pride.
I'm very privileged, and I don't know if these people know that they're very privileged to be able to walk in a public space and be queer or trans.
There are a lot of people who were walking the walk a long time before I got there. So I feel a debt now to the folks who went before.
The idea of coming out, you know, from person to person is so different.
We found each other, but we didn't know about all the rest of us.
I'm gay.
Each June in cities across the country, thousands of people take the streets, dancing, flaunting, staring, and celebrating an infinite array of expressions of gender and sexualities. Gay pride parades date back to the 1969 March on Stonewall in New York City, a protest against discrimination and violence that followed the historic uprising at a Greenwich Village bar where gays, lesbians, and transgendered people stood up to police harassment.
Portland's Pride Parade was June 18th. We asked people whether they see Pride celebrations today as a political or cultural event, and how Pride experiences translate into daily life. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll hear from a variety of people talking about identity, community, and activism. And we'll hear stories about love, coming out, and organizing. We'll also hear an interview with Olympia activist Billy Rain of Planting Seeds Community Awareness Project, a website that includes resources, music, and art, dedicated to ending oppression and bringing out liberation.
Genderqueer folks are always kind of put on the position of identifying. There's this kind of otherness that happens. You know, I don't mind, but everyone has identities, and that what happens is that we just naturalize it to the point where we say, I just am me. Well, that's an identity. Let's like break it down and see. Okay, so it'd be like heteronormative woman or something. You know, that's an identity. So I mean, for myself, you know, I usually think of it in terms of a trans-bodied, all gender femme, omnisexual. So kind of breaking down those different levels of identity.
One of the things that we talk about when we do trainings about gender is there's a couple of different components about gender, and one of them is gender identity, which is how I feel about myself and my own gender, and gender expression, which is how I express my gender. And there's also gender presentation, which is kind of like how people read you.
I consider myself a human, and that's really everything. Like, I am a sexual being, and I interact with different people. And really, when I look at someone, I look deeper into who they are, interaction, like what they can offer me, instead of their outward appearance, because almost always that can be deceiving.
I do identify as a lesbian. For the most part, I'm just a student.
For me, I don't really like know if I like label myself. I mean, I recognize that I'm a gay person and I'm a gay human being and everything, but I don't really feel like I like label myself as being gay. I just think I am who I am. If someone wants to be gay, if they want to be a lesbian, bi, trans, it doesn't matter to me. As long as you are who you are and you don't have to put up that fake barrier to someone, I'll care about you no matter who you are.
I'm a woman, and that's how I identify.
Well, I'm most used to talking about how I identify my sexual orientation and gender identity because of my job. So I identify as genderqueer and gender fluid and as queer. I also identify as a white Jew from an upper middle class background, although I'm fairly low income right now. To me, I identify as genderqueer, and I'm just saying my own definition because I think there's a lot of definitions depending on who's saying it. I identify as genderqueer because I don't prefer to live in either specific gender. I'm gender fluid, so that means that my gender changes, you know, depending on the year, sometimes day to day. Sometimes I dress kind of femme, like today, or sometimes I dress more like butch or more like masculine, or sometimes, a lot of the time, actually, I'm kind of androgynous. Although, I think, like, I'm getting a little bit more femme because my hair is getting a little bit longer, so people don't read me as androgynous anymore.
I think first I identify myself as a gay man because that has formed so much of my identity. I mean, part of that is because of the way our society treats that and has separated me from everyone else. It's kind of led me to highlight the differences, and then that's become how I came to identify myself. I'm not sure if there was a different world if that's the way I would identify myself. Secondly, I identify myself as an artist. My artwork is about revolution. As an artist, I stay away from decoration. As a painter, painting has been done over and over again, and it's been said that it's a dead art. And for me as an artist, that leaves only one thing, the message and what you're trying to say. So my work is about revolution and spreading a message about revolution, about change, about thinking of things in a different way, trying to foment change in our society and giving people a different way of looking at things rather than just decoration.
And there's some of it up at City Hall right now until the end of this month.
You fall in love with whoever you fall in love with. I'm with a beautiful young lady right now, so yeah, I'm a lesbian and I'm excited. So.
I call myself a gay woman.
And I'm a lesbian woman.
I'm a gay man. Pretty simple. I've been out since probably high school. I had my first boyfriend when I was senior in high school. So.
How was that, being out at that time?
It was hard. It was in Tillamook, Oregon, really small farming community. We found each other, but we didn't know about all the rest of them. Years later, of course, I learned other people were, but so as soon as I got the opportunity to move away from there, I did. Came to Portland.
Progressive. More than progressive, I'm radical. And I don't really feel like I have a sexual identity too much. I'd say I'm bisexual, but I'm pretty asexual. I'm kind of a non-relationship person.
I identify as a bisexual yet mostly queer art fag who hates labels.
Being involved with the HRC and also being a gay man, I feel it's important to make my voice and my presence known. So I guess I could identify myself as an activist, even though I'm not someone who's going to be sitting down in the middle of the road, you know, to stop traffic. I feel like there is a place for my voice to be heard in my everyday life with my coworkers, my family, and my friends. This is, I think, an outward expression of being able to do that, being an open person.
Well, both of us are Native American, and we do a lot of stuff with, you know, around our culture and things like that. And so we're really into family. We spend a lot of times with our families and things like that. And lesbian gay culture is important to me. She's straight, but, you know, that's a little iffy.
Maybe I'm still in the closet. I don't know.
How is it being from Native American culture? How is it being out?
Everyone's pretty accepting. Down in Grand Round, where I'm from, where my grandparents are from, my family that I grew up with always knew, you know, so it was not a big thing. I didn't, like, come out. And so, Native American culture, generally, people are good, accepting, I mean.
But she's running for tribal council, which hasn't been anybody on tribal council gay, so she's going to be the first gay person.
Oh, yeah. If I get it, I'll be the first gay council member, lesbian council member.
This is Billy Rain of Planting Seeds Community Awareness Project.
Olympia is a small community. It's pretty supportive of queers, I think, in general. Pride in Olympia is small. I used to live in Seattle, so I'm kind of used to really big Seattle pride, but it was fun. I mean, it's definitely political, as long as heterosexism, homophobia, transphobia, and various sort of sexual and gender-based oppressions are prominent in society. It's a political act. Go into public and say that you're not ashamed of those things about yourself. But, I mean, really, you know, more to me, it's more like a celebration and a way to see people and say hi in more of a celebratory context rather than necessarily part of what I would consider my organizing. It's like the big gay holiday, you know? It's kind of like gay Christmas. I have multiple chemical sensitivities, so going to public events is kind of difficult for me. For example, I'm sensitive to most chemicals and pretty much any synthetic fragrance. Car exhaust and diesel fumes make me extremely ill. So, I mean, like, I only went for about an hour, and then I started getting sick and had to go home. I've been to Pride pretty much every year, but one of the reasons I left Seattle was because I couldn't really handle the pollution, people's personal pollution. I have a lot of different identities, and it's actually quite overwhelming for me and most people for me to, like, put them all out on the table at the same time. You know, I'm a survivor of abuse, which is a huge part of my day-to-day life. It's a part of my public life, so pretty much most people know that if they know me at all. Most people know me as queer and disabled and racially mixed, probably. Although in different communities, you know, those various experiences are more prominent than in others. The queer community is definitely, I consider, my home community, but it's definitely not the only community I'm in. And I'm definitely in, you know, like a very specific part of queer community where in my social network, being racially mixed, for example, is common. It's not like a sort of an outsider identity. And most of my friends are disabled. On the other hand, I'm part of survivor communities where, not that I'm in the closet, it's just not as much of an issue. I don't talk about it as much. I probably would be really unhappy if I didn't have a lot of friends who are, like, you know, mixed, queer, trans, disabled survivors. But the fact is that almost everyone I know shares, you know, some or most of those experiences with me, so it makes it easier for me to kind of, you know, interact outside of that circle. I mean, there's definitely things, like, for example, I'm really into kink, and, like, within survivor communities, that issue is kind of touchy for a lot of people, and I generally don't really talk about it, and I think that I would be really bummed about that if I didn't have my personal group of friends who are survivors who are into kink and blah, 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 you know? But because I have a really, really supportive friendship network, it makes it easier for me to be okay having limited participation in a lot of different communities. To me, there's not one community that I feel like this community really accepts me. I generally feel that in every community, including sort of the broader queer community, I don't necessarily feel that I'm fully a part of any of those communities. I definitely feel that I have a really tight-knit circle of friends that I'm a part of that is very supportive, and we help each other deal with the difficulties of trying to interact with these sort of larger communities. I definitely identify as an activist, and I think it's especially important for me as a person with disabilities to embrace what I do that's uniquely shaped by my experience of disability as activism, because I think a lot of people outside disability communities don't recognize and don't honor a lot of things that people do that doesn't fit into certain models of activism, which aren't necessarily accessible to me and other people in my community. I mean, I think anything that I do or a person does to create the kind of sort of healthy world and healthy communities that we want is activism. I don't think that the concept of activism necessarily needs to be that complicated. I think the more that we broaden it, the more affirming of an environment we can create for the various different kinds of things people do, and also for the ways people embody the kinds of qualities that we want to see in the world, and so that it doesn't have to be necessarily defined by a certain action, but that we can learn to appreciate different ways of being as being part of activism. And I think for me, as a person with disabilities specifically, it's really important for me to challenge the concept of activism as this sort of narrow, you know, or going to protests and going to public events and doing specific kinds of activities and working for nonprofits. And I can't really do most of those things. And I actually have really not been welcomed into a lot of organizations because of the accommodations I need to physically participate in things. And so it's really important for me to embrace other ways of conceiving activism that are more inclusive of the kind of activities that I actually can do. So the Planting Seeds Community Awareness Project is basically a vehicle for popular education and for getting out the work of ourselves and our friends. My partner, Bethel, and I started the website in 99, and hopefully, you know, people use it. I think people use it a lot as a resource to get information about different topics, and also we have a kind of a different perspective, I think, than maybe the average anarchist activist out there. So I think people look to our site for a unique perspective on different issues. One of the reasons why we started Planting Seeds was because we felt unrepresented in the activist communities that we were part of. And so both Vassal and I are Arab American, and I'm also racially mixed, like I said. And we felt that a lot of analysis around race and racism specifically, which was something we were working on a lot when we started the website, was not inclusive of the perspectives of Arab Americans and racially mixed people. And so one of the first things that we did that was the main project we were working on when we started Planting Seeds was doing challenging racism popular education workshops. You have to remember this is before September 11th when people started really noticing how much of a target group Arab Americans are. At the time, we weren't really perceived necessarily across the board as people of color. It was something that a lot of people just didn't even think of. And you know, when you see lists of groups of people of color, like 95% of the time, we wouldn't be listed. And so, I mean, we kind of started it. Really, it was totally selfish. We were not satisfied with what was going on in anti-racist activism and anti-racist education. And we also felt that people needed to have a more integrated analysis of oppression, you know, trying to link all these different issues together rather than breaking them all up and dealing with them separately. So we decided to start an organization, basically, that didn't try to, like, separate all these different things and sort of be mono-issue focused, but tried to bring stuff together and create a more inclusive and holistic view of activism and anti-racism specifically at the time. And then from there, every time we felt like there was sort of something missing or something that needed to happen and we didn't see other people doing it, we kind of just tacked it on to what we were doing so that we would be sort of continuing to follow that same idea that we had when we started, that basically we as individuals have a unique perspective, and that's what we have to offer as activists, is that unique perspective. We also started a sub-project of Planting Seeds called Healing Trauma for Activists, which was basically coming from our experience working with trauma and trauma survivors and being trauma survivors and trying to bring knowledge and awareness of how people can work with trauma into the activist communities, particularly because at the time that we started it, there was a pretty sharp increase in people experiencing post-traumatic stress after these really large actions that were going on around the world. And there wasn't a lot of awareness about what trauma is and what you can do when you experience trauma. Part of my definition of liberation has to do with a state of consciousness and awareness that is not necessarily mutually exclusive with experiencing or not experiencing oppression. Because I feel that, you know, it's not that I'm hopeless that people could end oppression, but just I feel like it puts too much power in the oppressive structures to support an idea that we cannot have liberation in our lives until we eradicate these structures completely. And so I think that it's important for people to create liberation within themselves and within their communities that is, you know, to a certain extent independent of, you know, the larger struggles for liberation that are local, national, and global. Not that those aren't important, but that also that we seek liberation that we can actually achieve within ourselves because, you know, in my opinion, it is a natural state of being to be ourselves. These struggles, basically, we're struggling for the right to exist and for the right to be ourselves. So to that extent, liberation is basically us being who we are. And there's not really anything to say that we cannot be who we are, even within the context of an oppressive society and oppressive conditions. So I feel like that definition of liberation that is, I hope, complementary to definitions of liberation that talk about struggling against oppression and struggling against violence gives us a certain amount of you know, it's a hopeful thing to pursue because it's something that we actually can do, and it's not dependent on whether someone's trying to kill us or, you know, make us miserable or not, because we can have that kind of liberation regardless of what anyone else is doing to us or attempting to do to us in our community. Killing some abuse for me, a lot of it has been basically that it's kind of like I'm sorting through my inner life and figuring out what about the way I am with myself and in the world is unhealthy and abusive to myself because of the way I was treated when I was growing up, and then sort of taking each aspect of that and holding it and loving it and being compassionate and accepting myself, and through that creating the space where who I actually am starts to emerge. I've been doing healing work for seriously over a decade now, and so sometimes it's hard for me to remember that, you know, when I was, say, 18 or 19 and just leaving home, I really didn't love myself. I really didn't think I was a very good person, and I felt that there was a huge void inside of myself that I didn't really know if I would ever be able to fill. I just felt really empty, and I knew that I was an abuse survivor when I left home, but it's taken me about 10 years to kind of separate who I am from who I was taught to be by my parents and other adults that abused me when I was a child. And alongside that healing process, I've been consistently involved in what I consider to be radical activism. And so there's been a sort of symbiotic relationship for me between this liberation process that I've been going through with myself and the liberation process I go through within the context of my community and the larger world as an activist and also a person who experiences oppression myself. I'm at this point, I'm 32, not like I'm old, but, you know, I've had, say, 14 years of adult experiences, and I'm starting to realize that it's really unlikely that I will stop experiencing oppression in my lifetime. Not that I wouldn't be psyched if I did stop experiencing oppression, but I don't think it's very likely. But I do think that I can, at this point in my life, say that I love myself and I'm happy with my life, and I feel like I know how to take sort of difficult situations and approach them with a loving heart and with compassion for myself and for other people, and that this sort of happiness and compassion and ethical living is not defined by my access to, you know, I don't have to create a false happiness by buying into the sort of unethical, oppressive society we live in. And I also don't have to be unhappy my entire life because we live in a settler, colonial, imperial, oppressive, violent society either. I can actually experience a certain level of liberation within the life that I create and the life that I help build with other people.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7. June 17th and 18th marked Portland's annual Pride celebration. We continue with voices of participants, observers, and other local activists.
Why are you out here today?
Because I'm gay.
Oh, I forgot. How about you?
Because I'm with her. No, because I'm gay and it's fun and this is a celebration and I have pride of being gay.
It was wonderful. The weather was perfect. And I'm just so thrilled to be healthy at 80 so I can still strut in a gay parade.
Were you in the parade?
Mm, betcha.
This is my first gay pride.
It is exciting.
It's great. It's fabulous. There's so much things to do and the people are so bright and exuberant.
My friend Paul, who helped paint my boots last night, didn't want to come to Pride because he said it was too political. And I thought that was interesting to me because, to me, it's just about wrapping myself in colored saran wrap and kind of, I don't know. Well, I guess it is political, but I just wanted to dress up fabulous and be seen by many people.
When you're able to make an outward expression publicly, I think that definitely transitions into your personal day-to-day life. It makes that that ability to have a conversation with someone that much easier because you've already made that public.
And also, I haven't been to Portland Pride before, so I've been to the parade but not to the festival. It's great. Yeah, I mean, I moved up here from San Francisco 3 years ago, and I like it better. It's not as crazy. It's not as commercialized. This is the kids' tent. We support gay and lesbian families here, and this is a place where the families can come, and the kids can do crafts, and the babies can get changed, and the nursing mothers can sit here. So it's kind of a refuge from the hustle and bustle out there.
Well, you know, people do sort of get more extravagant during Pride. You won't see the fellas in leather, you know, walking around every day necessarily, unless they're maybe going to the Eagle or something. And also, you know, a lot of like the more sort of trans feminine personalities and really decked out like during Pride. So it kind of has like a Mardi Gras costume aspect to it. One of the things I noticed was that how many people I saw along the streets who didn't march. And, you know, I understand people's need for, you know, personal privacy and stuff. But I also think it's very important for as many people as possible to get out and stand up and say, we're here and we're people just like you. And I would have liked to have seen a lot of those folks who I know are queer in some way or trans in some way to be walking down that street so openly through the past the square at the same time.
Looking at these prides, I'm originally from Costa Rica, so the issue of having a pride march downtown San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica, would be kind of life-threatening. So I'm very privileged, and I don't know if these people know that they're very privileged to be able to walk in a public space and be queer or trans. That's not something that would happen very comfortably outside the United States, so that's why I participated, because it's a privilege that I cannot be part of in my country of origin, because there's issues of violence, right? And maybe I'm exaggerating, but there would be issues of violence maybe after the parade is done or before. But to my knowledge, I don't think there's like a big pride march in San Jose, Costa Rica right now.
I graduated from high school the year before the Stonewall riots took place. I'm from New York City, and I marched in the first parade in 1970, the year after the riots. So I've tried to come to as many of them since as I can.
You want to explain a little bit about the Stonewall riots for folks?
In 1969, in New York City, the climate was such that gay bars were frequently raided by the police. Bar owners used to have to either pay off police or the mafia for protection. And one night in June, the Stonewall Bar, which was in Greenwich Village, had its usual contingent of clientele, and there was a police raid, and people just had enough, and they fought back, and I believe the riots went on for at least several days. That was the start of it all. It was exciting. It was the start of a huge change for the better. And I think sometimes today, we can take for granted how far things have come, even though they're not perfect. So I'm very thankful for the people at Stonewall who stood up and said no more.
I didn't come out early in life. There are a lot of people who were walking the walk a long time before I got there. So I feel a debt now to the folks who went before, since what I have today, I have because of them.
I think one of the results of everything that's happened since Stonewall, and also since 1973 when Evelyn Hooker's groundbreaking research became known and homosexuality was removed from the American Psychiatric Association's Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the change has been so positive. It was the beginning of, I think, true individual pride for all of us as gay, lesbian, bisexual human beings, however we identify themselves. And that has allowed me to be who I am at work and not have to hide. Multnomah County, my employer, has a non-discrimination policy, as do many Fortune 500 companies. And I believe that what happened at Stonewall started it all.
One of the ways I put this into practice in my work life is I became identified as in my office as a safe place for people who felt they were being harassed. I put that up on the wall outside my office as a way of kind of identifying that some of the stuff that we've had to experience over time is just not okay anymore, and this is a safe place.
Have you seen a big trans presence here today?
Yes, I think it's lovely. And I like that I'm seeing a lot of trans guys that I know dressed up like in femme drag. I think that's awesome, and I like to see that kind of gender bending going on. It's really playful.
I really don't think there's any specific lesbian, gay, you know, bisexual, transgender community singular.
My family now, Pat is the first lesbian I ever saw, and I was 52, and I literally was led to her. It was a shock for my whole family, all my family, my sisters that were even older than I, all loved Pat. It took a little while.
I was working at Women in Transition. She had this spiritual thought that she was supposed to meet some woman's organization. And so she called Women in Transition and thought, this is the place I'm supposed to be.
I thought I was going for a job. And I saw Pat. She was coming home from her lunch hour. She said, the woman that's going to interview you, we've been together ever since.
How's that for a transition?
Wow.
And I've never regretted it for one moment.
My sign that says art fags are people too, and I was just kind of my own one man kind of part of the parade or something, and I was like, I don't know, I was surprised when people cheered. Like, I would walk by with the sign and people would cheer, like crowds of people, and I've just never experienced that before. And it's interesting that that I was just surprised by that. I guess I kind of assume that people aren't going to be friendly and receptive, which I think is probably something that happens when you're queer and from northern Minnesota, where you're not used to crowds of people liking you. So it's like most people are kind of against you, or you feel like that. So that's why I loved marching today. It was just like overwhelming crowds of support and cheering people. Very liberating.
We kind of became the token gay kids at our school, but we faced a lot of kids who at our school were really uncomfortable to come out, so they'd secretly like come up to us and they'd tell about how they were gay and they were going through stage and stuff. But it's kind of like for us, like, we have to kind of like fight even louder to like represent, and we have to fight against the administration and student body and staff to make sure that equality is going to spread, because, you know, people at our school recognize that we are gay and that we're not, we kind of put a face on the problem almost. And so when gay issues come out of school, they know that it's affecting us.
So have you had to face harassment?
Yes. Not from the students as much as from the staff and the administration of our school. The administration spent a lot of time and effort attempting to silence projects like the Laramie Project, and we also had Gay Straight Alliance shirts that we had wanted to make. We eventually got it done, but it took a lot of petitioning and effort to do it. The administration didn't want us to change our school logo. We were going to do the Southridge Skyhawk with a rainbow instead of its normal coloring.
I wish it was a political event. I'm not sure. Sometimes it's just a performance, and there is a political space for performance.
It's to celebrate being alive and being out and risking and trusting that there are people always ready to stand beside you if you're ready to stand up.
Today was different because I was hanging out with a six-year-old, and it was really fun hanging out with him, and he was carrying the pride flag with us, and he was just smiling and walking around and jumping. So it's really nice to see like the young, really young kids getting into it. Marching with this little boy that I was marching with today, I mean, people see that it's, you know, it's normal to be queer. It's as normative as being heterosexual.
I have my son here with me today just to see, you know, and he's seen a lot, but he's seeing, you know, people in bondage. He's seen people pass out condoms. And he's like, what is lube? And this is all important information, you know, for him to know in the future. So he's already exposed to it. And so when we get to that time, you know, it'll be a little easier for me to explain why you need condoms, why you need to protect yourself, why you need some lube. Because that's just as important. And to not judge anyone based on anything.
My daughter's 15. She's 15, so. But then that's kind of dating me, so I'm not telling my age. 15 going on 21, and that adds another dynamic. I think a lot of times, especially the larger communities, don't realize that we have lives, we love the same, we, you know, I have the same challenges with my daughter, you know, keeping her on task in school, and I'm a father, and that's just a part of who I am. Oftentimes, that's not the focus, you know, so much is just believing we're different when really there's so much more common than there is different.
My first parade was 30 years ago in San Francisco. I was 18 years old. Wow. So it's changed a lot, and this one's pretty cool though. Lots of different people, diverse. It's really cool that people can come out and just be themselves and not worry about being judged or bashed or something like that.
I live in Manzanita, Oregon coast.
When we were there, we went for a while to Calvary Bible Church, and they came out one day with this one man, one woman, go downstairs and sign it.
Political thing.
And we left the church. That was it. You know, that was just too darn pushy.
I feel it's really important culturally to come together in the Black community. My personal experience has been fractured within, like, the religious world, and just being accepted and understanding that nothing is wrong with me, that I am not a sinner, that, you know, that I was made this way, and that I am divinely blessed just as anybody else is, because I am a manifestation of the divine. We need to understand and accept each other in the church, outside of the church, and then go out into our neighborhoods and say, seriously, we need to just get along. We really just need to include each other and just grow from each other.
People have different feelings about pride, about, you know, the corporate direction that it's taken. So a lot of the more sort of activist part of the queer community don't really appreciate that too much. But I still think there's a value in marching down the center of Portland, Oregon, past the square on Father's Day with a bunch of queer people. I think it's lovely, it's wonderful, and it's harmless, and that it can only help.
I think it's political in terms of what I've been doing, because what I'm doing is supporting a queer youth organization, which I absolutely think that we need to have LGBTQQIAP specific services available to youth everywhere. And then this year and last year, we've been conducting surveys about tobacco use and tobacco prevention, and that serves kind of a double purpose. One is to gather information about smoking in our communities, and also to provide information about tobacco prevention. But I also think that generally Pride is not a political event. I think it's more of a cultural event. I think there are a lot of people who come and want to party. But then at the same time, like when I walk around in the booth, there's a lot of really amazing booths like that are going around that are providing social support in our community or providing political stuff. But I think those are fewer and further between than like the more commercial stuff that I see here.
I just think it's really important for people to really stand up and to really claim their legitimacy in this world. And I think one of the biggest problems with the queer community is internalizing a lot of the fear that the world expects us to have. And there's this, I don't know, an apprehension about getting up and being empowered, and that they're sweet, kind, and liberated human beings, and that we have so much to offer, and we're always approaching it from a victimized perspective. Please love us. Please give us non-discrimination legislation, because we're victims. And I think that's important. We also have to come up and claim our empowerment in this world and say that we have a lot to give as people. I think the more that happens, that the whole anxieties around queerness will be soothed somehow.
Three and a half years ago, and you can tell I've more than 29. it wasn't so much a surprise as an inevitability and a relief, because of all the stuff that I tried to do in my life up to that point that had never worked, this was the piece of the puzzle that went clunk and things made sense in a way that they'd never made sense before.
So how did you know?
I sat down one day in November and I started to write. I need to write about sexuality, mine, and every experience I'd had with a lesbian woman up to that time, friendships and events, and it all sort of flooded back. The feelings I had for the girl in high school when I was a junior. The singing group that identified themselves as three queers with a question mark, and I knew what that question mark meant. And I was not ready at that point in my life. When I sat down to write that day, everything just came together. And it was, as I said, a relief, a huge relief. It's been a relief ever since to not have to play a game that I never really felt part of.
Me and this person had our dates, and like, we slept in the same bed one night. She slept with her clothes off or something, and I like couldn't sleep, and I was really excited by it all. And then the next morning, I left her house. Buildings looked different. Everything looked completely different. Like, the whole world had changed. Like, everything looked like a heterosexual structure, and I was like, I am so different, and everything, my whole perspective, everything was just completely different just from sleeping next to this naked woman. We eventually kissed.
I live a life where I'm just out, and it just is, but it wasn't always that way. And honestly, the only people that I did sit down and tell that I was gay was first my brother, then my mom, and then the mother of my daughter. And then from there, I've never had that conversation. Like, once it was just a process of once I realized that they knew and they were okay, everyone else didn't matter. And from there, I just got the courage to be able to live my life and just be.
I'm talking about when I was 14 and I walked into Happy Dog, which was my neighborhood hot dog and hamburger stand. Mm-hmm. And I applied for a job, and I was really shy, really awkward 14-year-old. There was this girl working, flipping the burgers, and there was this lady working at Happy Dog, who's older lady, like she was 50 maybe, her name was Mary, and I filled out my whole application, and I walked up to the counter to give it to Mary, and she looked at the girl flipping hamburgers, who was like my age. She said, I bet you want to eat her pizza, don't you?
What? Wait, what did she say? And then what did you say?
I didn't say anything. I got out of there. But I got a job there.
I knew I liked women from a pretty early age. I didn't know what to call it till I was about 13 and heard the word lesbian. But I started having crushes on girls when I was about 10 years old. Haven't stopped.
Went to a women's gathering. While I was there, I met this very cute musician who was really excited to play music with me. And I played the fiddle on the porch every day for 7 hours, like more than I'd ever played. I mean, even for Allstate Orchestra, I never played that much. And the whole time I'm doing the whole, like, but I'm not gay. So I'm telling this talented and handsome musician the whole time, oh, but I'm straight. And she kept going, I don't think you are straight. And she was right.
And a lot of times when I talk to my grandma, sometimes she would say, do you have a boyfriend? And I would say no. But this particular time, she phrased it differently and said, are you going out with anybody or something like that? So I said, yeah, I am. And she said, oh, what's his name? I told her, I don't remember how I said it, but I said, actually, I have a girlfriend, Grandma. She paused, and then she said, well, do you love her? And I said, yeah. And she said, that's good. That's what's important. And then she never mentioned it again.
I totally had a crush on this person, Valerie, but I didn't know it, that that's what it was. I just knew that I thought she was really, really, really cool. And this went on, and like, I ended up going home and nothing happened. And I was like, oh, I should have kissed her. Something should have happened. So I went home to my boyfriend and woke up at 3 in the morning after having a fantasy that I was like, with four women having sex like all night long. The next day I told my boyfriend I was bisexual.
She was in the kitchen. I was sitting with her at the kitchen table, and I got up and I went to the living room, and I was kind of pacing around trying to figure out what I was going to say. And I said, you know, Gwydion's not my Valentine, Mom. And this is like from room to room, and she's like, oh, really? Well, oh, okay. And I said, do you know who is? And she's like, no. I said, Julie, Mom. And that was how I came out to my mom, because I couldn't even be in the same room with her. I was so freaked out.
The idea of coming out, you know, from person to person is so different. For me, I feel really, really fortunate because I was really young when I realized I was gay. I never dated anyone other than men. Very early, I realized where my attraction was, and it's really weird for me in a way because I don't even think of going through the process of coming out. I feel like to some degree, I was always out. The degree to which I may have come out, I had to more so do with realizing that there was a name and a community that I could pretty much connect to, you know, the gay community.
SMRC is the Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center. We serve LGBTQQIAP youth, ages 23 and younger. That stands for
okay.
Yeah, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex, asexual, pansexual, and allies. And I use all those letters because the youth actually use all those letters. And then there are people who are left out, like genderqueer. So we serve LGBTQQIAP youth ages 23 and younger. We have a resource center in Portland that's open on Wednesdays from 4 to 9 and Fridays from 4 to 11 p.m. And that has a lot of resources. There's free food, and so youth can come in and cook dinner if they need food. We offer counseling, free counseling. There's a youth steering committee that makes the decisions about the space. And then we also have other community programs. One is the Washington County Pride Project, and Bridge 13, which is a community education program, and Breathe Free, which is the program I coordinate, the LGBTQ Coalition Against Tobacco, which is the only program that serves youth and adults.
Here with SMRC, the Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, and we're handing out flyers and taking surveys for this year's Tobacco Coalition, the LGBTQ Breathe Free. Breathe Free is actually found through many surveys that people who are LGBTQ tend to have a higher percentage of smoking because of the stress that's brought on, either in like coming out or hiding from your peers or just being different. People tend to smoke more.
Our youth smoke anywhere from like 38 to 60%. They're more likely to smoke. They're more likely to have friends who smoke. Also, LGBTQ youth have higher risks across a lot of different indicators, not just smoking, but also substance abuse, partner violence, four or more sex partners before they graduate from high school, risky sex practices, teen pregnancy, rape, suicide attempts, all of these different things. And so that to me, you know, speaks to why we need to have programming specifically that gets rid of homophobia and transphobia in our schools. I think people should look up the information on the GLSEN website about the national data. GLSEN is the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Education Network, and it's GLSEN.org. They do a survey every other year about the experiences youth have in schools around homophobia and transphobia. They've been able to link verbal harassment to lowered grade point average and lower desire to go on to college. Very valuable information. I could go on.
drekweb.com. And the third issue of Drek should be up in a couple days. Yeah, this is our political issue.
My name is Anthony Antoine, and at www.anthonyantoine.com, and I was just here to perform last night and today. So.
Well, the Laramie Project is a play that many schools around Oregon and the United States put on as a way to bring to mind like what happens in a society when like a tragedy like Matthew Shepard's murder happens. It's actually a really moving play to read, and it also is on video. Our school had to lobby for it. The school eventually performed it. I wasn't in it. He was assistant director though.
For us, like, it was a huge struggle for us, A, because we're, like, gay students and everything, but B, because it's also, we're, like, face-to-face, like, lied a lot by the administration at our school, like, as to why they were canceling it. They came to our GSA meetings, and they actually stated that the reason that they were canceling the show was because of language and everything, when really we actually found the letter that they wrote to the theater arts director as to why they canceled it, and it, they listed that homophobic issues were one reason that they canceled it. So it was kind of, like, impactful for us that our school administration would come and blatantly, like, lie to the gay student and staff members of our school. So, I mean, it's a big struggle, but it was worth every battle.
I've been volunteering with Brother to Brother, and just starting to trust community again with these guys. Brother to Brother is an organization for Black gay men and for anybody else who is working towards equality for all people.
It's a organization that caters pretty much to African-American men, gay men, bisexual, trans, and, you know, we serve as support and resource. I'm one of the founding members. I was here from the very beginning, 13 years, actually. It was a group of African-American gay men decided that Portland was ripe for some kind of organization. I think primarily for younger people to, you know, have a place to go and, you know, just kind of pull our resources and support one another. Certainly in the case of Portland, the African American population is fairly small, and then within that population, the lesbian and gay community is even smaller. And so I think primarily the need is for the support and kind of a shared cultural background. I also started a group called the Imani Group, and it's like a potluck social gathering that happens the first Sunday of each month. It's really surprising. African-American men and women, lesbian and gay from across the country, we gather. And it's really surprising, from the West Coast to the East Coast, people from the Midwest and the South, we all really feel, every time we get together, no matter what part of the country we're from, we really have this shared cultural background. And we get together and we just have a really good time. And it's a good time that's really unique.
I'm with Equity Foundation, and we're giving out information about our organization. Equity is a philanthropic organization that basically raises money, turns right around, and gives it away to the GLBT community. We have about 60-some organizations that receive our grants each year, so kid groups, scholarships, school groups, you know, that are doing things to promote no hate in schools, people's choice, you know, right to choice, and all kinds of things, just a wide diversity of it.
And are you a local organization?
We serve all of Oregon and Southwest Washington.
The organization that I work for, Outside In, was marching in the parade, and I work at the Trans Identity Resource Center. So I was marching to kind of raise awareness of our program and to let people know that Outside In is a very trans-positive agency. The agency also has, in the clinic, a trans healthcare clinic. Outside In is a safe space for all queer folks to access services. You know, one service that probably gets accessed the most is a project called the Identity Project. And that's where we help people get a new Oregon ID with a new name and new gender designation on it. We also have an open house each week called Gender Blends, which is sort of our support environment. It's also kind of fun, a way to meet folks from all the complete spectrum of gender experience. Our program also hosts the Portland Bad Dateline, which is a resource for people doing sex work. You know, we also have stuff like hormone syringe exchange, to a great deal of peer counseling. Our staff, we have a really nice selection of people from all different gender experiences, so they're always there to chat with folks. We have a project we've done in collaboration with PSC Library, where we've established a trans reference library with over 400 trans-specific titles. And probably the biggest section is queer and trans theory. It's quite a treat for Portland to have that much information in one spot.
And that's at PSU?
That's at our space, at Turk. Pretty much during our hours, Tuesday through Friday, 11 to 5, people can access the library. And it is a reference library, so unfortunately we can't let people check stuff out. They're more than welcome to make copies and to just sit there and browse through all this stuff. And in the big scheme of things, 400 books might not seem like a lot, but to have that many trans-specific titles in one place is pretty monumental.
You've
been listening to Circle A Radio. Seattle will be celebrating gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and queer pride June 23rd and 24th. For more information, visit seattlepride.org. We would also like to announce an event for Seattle's Queer People of Color Liberation, a group of artists, organizers, and activists who have come together to create a series of theater productions and discussion series. The year-long project focuses on the lives, issues, and perspectives of queer, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and gay people of color. Their first performance, Beneath, will be held July 2nd in Seattle. For more information, check out their website at qpocliberation.org. That's qpocliberation.org.
Some of the other organizations that were mentioned in today's show are Planting Seeds Community Awareness Project, on the web at pscap.org, SMRC, the Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, at smyrc.org. Information about TURC, the Trans Identity Resource Center, is available on Outside In's website at outsidein.org. And Brother to Brother is on the web at brotobropdx, that's brotobropdx.org. Circle A Radio is on the air every first and third Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM. Our website is circlearadio.org, where you can listen to some of our shows online. We love hearing from you, and you can contact us at info@circlearadio.org. We'll be on again July 5th. Thanks for listening.
You know, at the end of the industrial food chain, organic or conventional, is an industrial eater. So you've got to change the way we eat, the way we consume, before you can change the whole system. And what happens when you get out of the supermarket, when you go to the farmer's market or join the CSA, Community Supported Agriculture, is that suddenly, I mean, a whole world opens up. You will not find processed food. You will not find strawberries 12 months of the year. You will find what the land produces now where you live.
Do you wonder where your food comes from? Why is eating locally a revolutionary act? You'll hear answers to these questions and more when you tune into KBOO this Friday, June 23rd at 9 a.m. Hear Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, talk about how to disconnect from the industrial food chain. Only on KBOO, your community-powered radio station.